It's been confirmed that Prince Charles will take over from the Queen as the next head of the Commonwealth. The decision's been made by leaders during a meeting at Windsor Castle. Theresa May's welcomed the news.
His Royal Highness has been a proud supporter of the Commonwealth for more than four decades and has spoken passionately about the organisation's unique diversity. And it is fitting that one day he will continue the work of his mother, Her Majesty the Queen.
I just said round two. It sounds like it's a boxing match. It's not. It's lovely and friendly and fluffy here. Our thanks go to Councillor Tony Carey for joining us in hour one. Hour two, it's more sort of conspiratorial international news. And I
where should we start?
Where do we start? I feel like it's like take a deep breath, dive in, and mention the word Syria.
Okay.
Where do we? Well, I've got some clips actually. Duma, right? The yeah. truth of the search for the truth about Duma. What do you believe happened there?
Well, obviously we're still finding out. There's been stuff I'm seeing earlier on today where. Basically, it looks as if nothing. There was a staged event, which didn't involve any chemical weapons as such. And on the back of that, we basically lobbed a load of missiles at them. I think it's going to come out that there was nothing much there, and that it was a staged event. The Russian general staff are suggesting that the White Helmets who staged the event.
You need to explain what the
White Helmets are supposedly called Syrian Civil Defence, but they are in fact a kind of front organisation for two sets of people. One is the Al Qaeda jihadists, which they're embedded with, and the other they were set up by a guy called James Le Mesurier, who was a British Army intelligence officer based in Turkey. And they actually take quite a lot of money from the British taxpayer and the US taxpayer. But they only operate in Al-Qaeda controlled areas in Syria. And in the past, it's pretty clear that they've been faking chemical weapons attacks in order to provoke outside intervention. And I think that's what's happened here.
Right.
It's another one of those.
Yeah, I mean, It's interesting to see here you say, you know, we don't know what's happened yet, because, I mean, I'll be honest, I haven't really sort of kept a really, really close interest in this, but, you know, you look at the sort of the various parties involved, you know, who do you trust? Well, I don't really trust the Russians. I don't really trust the UK government to tell me the truth. I don't really trust these, I don't know, ISIS or ISIL or Islamic terrorists or whatever, you know, so it's a...
Well, yeah, that's the point. I mean, the thing is that because you've got all of these different interests embedded in the situation, it's wise for people to say, well, we don't really know what went on here. Mm. And that's what I'm saying, although right. In fact, if you actually ask my copper's hunch, I would say that the White Helmets... staged the event. I mean, they've interviewed people. There's a boy who was actually sprayed with water, yeah. Mm. And what happened? And he's been identified. He's been interviewed today with his father. And what they said, the White Helmet said to people, if you go to the hospital, you'll get free food.
Right.
So these people turned up for free food, and then they were doused with water and with a camera on them, and it was then presented to the world as a chemical weapons attack.
Right.
Yeah. That seems to be what's been going on. But of course, the chemical weapons inspectors are there because it's all under the control of the Syrian army now, and they've given them access. But that's what they've been saying all along. This whole thing was a staged event. Mm. But of course, if you go back to the original chemical weapons attack in Ghouta in 2014, people were killed there. That was a definite chemical weapons attack, but that was carried out by the al-Nusra Front with sarin supplied from Libya via Turkey. And that was all in Simon Hirsch's very interesting article, The Red Lines and the Rat Lines, in the London Review of Books in 2015. And I don't suppose Theresa May has read it, but she should have.
No, probably not, no. I don't know if this is relevant, though, but I mean, obviously, you know, chemical weapons are being used and have been used in the past. Now, ISIS, it is claimed, Islamic State has used chemical weapons, including chlorine and sulfur mustard agents, at least 52 times in the battlefield in Syria and Iraq since it swept to power in 2014, says a new...
Well, the Syrian army today and the Russians are saying that they've captured quite a few chemical weapons... and they said, and Maria Zakharova earlier was saying, and guess what? One of the tubs of chlorine that we found definitely came from Salisbury.
Okay,
yeah, but from I mean, that's down.
Can you?
No, in other words, this whole, if you think, look, take a step back, this whole idea of chemical weapons being an evil thing and therefore we've got to, you know, it's a red line that we've got to do something about. In actual fact, chemical weapons, horrible as they are no worse than conventional bombs and bullets. They kill just in the same sort of way.
Yeah.
But the West has made a big deal out of chemical warfare as a line-crossing thing and weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. You remember all of that, and they turned out not to be there. In actual fact, you know, the Saudis are dropping white phosphorus in Yemen, which is also a chemical weapon. The Israelis use white phosphorus against Gaza. In the siege of Fallujah, the first siege of Fallujah, the Americans drop white phosphorus all over it. Now, I obviously all of these weapons are horrible. You know, let's not kid ourselves. None of it's nice. But the idea that a particular class of weapon is particularly evil is actually a trope of Western political manipulation.
Well, indeed, it's particularly evil only if the other guys have it.
Well, that's right, because in actual fact, Portland, you see, the Russians got it in 2015. They got a clean bill of health from the OPCW that they got rid of all of their chemical weapons. Craig Murray, who was the British ambassador in Uzbekistan at the time, that was where their Portland Down was. The whole place was dismantled. The Americans went in there and dismantled it and took everything away. And the Russians basically have a policy: we don't want, need chemical weapons. Look at our nuclear weapons.
Right.
Look at that. Mm. That's what we're going to use if you attack us. And of course, under the agreement, Portland Down should be closed down. But far from being closed down as a result of the recent events, there's going to be a massive investment program so that it can be expanded. And that, I suggest, has got a lot to do with what's going on here.
Indeed. Now, you mentioned a while back that some chemical weapons were found with a Salisbury mark on them.
Well, that's what the Russians were saying this afternoon. And no doubt they will show that to the chemical weapons inspectors. And, and if they're independent and if it's true, then we will find out more.
Mm. But don't you think, if it is true, that the British authorities would be wise enough to anonymise any exports?
Well, you'd have thought so, but I mean, we don't know. Let's be clear, yeah? We're speculating. Yeah. The fact is that chemical weapons were smuggled into Syria to be used by jihadist groups as false flags, so that they could then say, oh, Assad is using gas on us, therefore we have to have Western intervention. And by making a red line of use of chemical weapons, leaving aside that NATO's sticking their finger in, every jihadist group has got an interest in using chemical weapons and trying to blame Assad, because that will bring in outside intervention, which is the only way they're ever going to win the war. And, of course, many of them are not even Syrians.
Yeah,
tens of thousands of them that have been infiltrated into Syria. They're from Chechnya, some of them from Uyghurs from China, and lots of Saudis, Libyans.
Yeah. Well, let's take a step back, or indeed several steps back, I think, to sort of, because that's, seeing the big picture might help us to sort of analyse, you know, who's motivated to do what. So, but where do we start? Okay, what does the West want?
Well, they've always been hostile to Syria as a regime ever since the 1940s. The Ba'athist regime in Syria has been something that they haven't liked.
Right.
When Bashar al-Assad came to power not long ago, because it was his elder son, who was his elder brother, who was actually put in line for the throne, as it were, of Syria, but he got killed in a car accident or by accident or whatever.
Right.
And then Bashar al-Assad was actually living here with Asmar Assad, working as an optician. And they came and said, well, you've got to come back and be president of Syria. And I said, well, I don't want to be president of Syria. I'm quite happy living in Britain being an optician.
Mm.
And what the people said to him is, you've got to come back, because otherwise there's going to be a huge infight and the country will go to pieces. So reluctantly, Bashar al-Assad went back to be president, even though he hadn't wanted to be.
Okay, a former British resident who presumably speaks English very well.
Yes,
you'd imagine that the UK government would be naturally quite warm
towards him. Well, in actual fact, when he first came to power, he was regarded as a new face, as a new generation, different kind of attitude. You know, if you remember Saddam Hussein marching, with battle fatigues on and firing rifles. I mean, if you see Bashar al-Assad, he's always wearing a sensible business suit and a tie, because that's his image.
Okay.
Yeah? And, of course, within Syria itself, they did hold an election in 2012, which the West refused to recognise. But if you actually look at the returns, he overwhelmingly won it. And that's as a result of the war, his popularity has actually increased because he's seen as a figure of stability. And also, in some sense, is like a kind of Abraham Lincoln figure. He's holding the country together.
Yeah.
Because it's actually, you've got a Sunni majority in Syria, but you've got very substantial Shia and Christian minorities, and Druze as well. So it's always been a very multi-ethnic, multicultural place. So it can't really be run as a kind of one theocracy state. I mean, the Muslim Brotherhood are the core of the opposition to the Ba'athist regime in Syria. And right. They are basically aligned with Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and they want a Sunni state right. with Sharia law.
Right.
But of course, most people in Syria, including Sunnis, don't want that. And the Sunni the Syrian Arab Army, the officer corps were overwhelmingly Sunni. So in other words, the Alawites, which is what Bashar al-Assad is, get to run the politics. The Christians get to run the business. And the Sunnis run the army.
Yeah.
And of course, what the West thought was that the army would then split because they're all Sunnis. They would split. But in actual fact, the Sunni officers of the army have carried on fighting for the regime. Because, most Sunnis in Syria are not extremist in their views. They're Sunnis by history and tradition, but they're not Saudis.
But everything you're describing sounds amenable to the West, doesn't
it? Well, the problem is that the West could always have done business to solve these problems. But don't forget, there's a complicating factor, is the Israelis hate Syria, the Syrian regime. As far as they're concerned, it's absolute no-no. They don't like it at all. And the other thing that people have been talking about, the Qataris wanted to run a pipeline through Syria because the real struggle is the gas market in Europe. Yeah, that's the prize. At the minute, it's being supplied by the Russians. About a third of the gas comes from Russia. And if they could get an amenable Syrian regime to take gas from where Qatar is directly to the coast there, and then that could be sold on to Europe, that would undercut the Russians.
Right.
But Bashar al-Assad turned that down. He said, I don't want to do that. We're going to run an alternative pipeline from Iran through Syria, and that will supply Europe.
Yeah.
So a lot of this stuff is to do with where pipelines are going to be. And, of course, the problem with all the fighting is that you can't really build pipelines in war zones, and they don't survive very well. But at the very least, you can stop other people building their pipeline.
Yeah.
But the West do not want to see an Iranian pipeline coming through Syria, supplying Europe with gas, which will help complement the Russian gas, but it makes the Americans are pushed out. Yeah, they're out of the game if that starts to happen.
How are the Americans out of the game? Because Americans don't supply us gas.
The Americans have got this the shale gas, which they're now supplying through ships. Yeah,
right.
So what they're trying to stop the Nord Stream pipeline being built, which would bring gas directly from Siberia to Germany. Yeah. So there's all of this pipeline politics going on behind the scenes.
Yeah.
And then there's also the visceral hostility of the Israelis towards the Arab regime. And don't forget that after the fall of the Soviet Union and 9/11, the aspirations of the West have massively increased. They were happy to tolerate things, which now they're not prepared to tolerate. They feel they've got the power to go in there and get what they want. They thought Assad would fall like Gaddafi. Mm. Yeah. Gaddafi lasted put a much better fight than they imagined, but they got rid of him, and they were just going to go straight and do the same thing in Syria. But Syria's a much more complicated place. Yeah?
Right.
You can't, and Syria, the Syrian regime has got more allies. You know, Gaddafi didn't really have anybody to help him when it came down to it, whereas the Syrians have.
Yeah, but Europe is a big, powerful player, and Europe doesn't want to be dependent on Russia for gas. So it's in Europe's interest, surely, to have more sources of gas.
Well, that's true, but at the same time, the Russian gas is the cheapest. So from the real danger for the Americans is if Russian gas and natural resources are allied with German capital and know-how, then they're going to create an export machine which will do the business on them, and they don't want that. They are determined to keep the current they want a unipolar world order with America as top dog.
Mm.
They don't want to negotiate with the Russians or the Chinese or anybody else to share it all out. They're not interested in that.
Yeah.
They should be. because it's actually common sense.
Well, quite,
we could,
we could just
divvy all this up, and we could all do business with each other, and we could all be fine.
Yeah.
But you've got to remember that that's not the mentality. They want to be the top dog, and they're not prepared to share.
No, of course not. Now, a friend of mine many years ago read a book which is a sort of big conspiracy theory book, and I'm giving you clues in the hope that you can identify the conspiracy theory. It all centres on Damascus, and the book says that basically it's, I think it's a, probably driven by religious nutters, you know, for waiting for the end times and so on. And when Damascus falls, it's time for us to build our nuclear bunker. Does that ring any bells to you?
Well, Damascus is a strategic place. I mean, don't forget that the Chinese are talking about this One Belt, One Road project, where they're going to put in state-of-the-art transport links across Asia.
Well, indeed, they've done it, haven't they?
Yeah,
the rail, Silk Rail, is existing.
And so if you look at Syria's location... It's a key node in that, and that's one of the reasons why they've got to get a regime in Syria, which is, or the West has got to get a regime in Syria, which is not going to be amenable to the Chinese strategy. Now, the West ought to actually, to my mind, accept that the Chinese are going to do this and work with them to make it work. But the fact of the matter is that the people in the Pentagon and Wall Street and all the rest of it are not prepared to do that. They're doing everything they can to prevent that kind of multipolar world from developing.
Yeah, but I mean, Syria, obviously there's, if you imagine China and Europe, there's a lot of land in between.
Yeah.
And Syria isn't necessarily a bottleneck. There's ways around Syria.
No, indeed, but I mean, there's also these pipelines I was talking about earlier, because that's quite important. And also, there's just sheer bureaucratic inertia. They used to overthrow, you know, they really thought they were on a roll after they'd overthrown Gaddafi and made Libya into a kind of living hell that it's become today. And they really thought that Assad, if you think back 7 years ago, they were saying, oh, it'll only be there for another week. It'll be gone in a month's time.
Right.
It'll be gone in a year's time. 7 years later, he's still standing. And many of the politicians who said he wouldn't be there have gone. And in actual fact, in Middle Eastern political terms, he's now becoming a major figure, like General Abdel Nasser was after he nationalised the Suez Canal.
Yeah.
Because they've managed to stand up,
defeat the West,
and of course, ultimately, of course, the real possibility is there's going to be a war between Israel and Syria,
yeah,
the Iranians and the Russians on the Syrian side.
Again, looking at the big picture then, what's the Russian point of view in all this?
Well, the Russians, they don't really want to... the idea that they're expansionist is silly. What they want is that their own little... You know, their part of the world to be under their control, and they need to feel unthreatened in it. And Syria, you know, what happened, if you remember, with Libya, was that there was... Because of the idea that the Libyans were using aircraft against demonstrators... If you remember all of this, that there had to be a no-fly zone over Libya.
Right.
Now, the West went to the UN Security Council and said, we want a no-fly zone over Libya to stop the Libyan Air Force being used against demonstrators. And both the Chinese and the Russians at that stage abstained, therefore allowing a no-fly zone to be created. And what they presumed was going to happen is that the no-fly zone would prevent the Libyan Air Force from bombing demonstrators, and then the West would look for a political solution.
Mm.
Yeah? Gaddafi would have to talk to the opposition, something would have to be worked out. But of course they didn't do that. They took that UN resolution as an excuse to start a bombing campaign against the Libyan armed forces,
yeah,
which went on for months and killed tens of thousands of people. Most people have forgotten all about it. They haven't forgotten about it in Libya. And of course, eventually Gaddafi is sodomized with a bayonet by jihadis working with French special forces. And Hillary Clinton goes, we saw, he died. Ha ha ha. And of course, at that point, the Russians and the Chinese say, well, we're not giving you any more no-fly zones. You can forget about that. And there's no way. And not only are going to not give you a no-fly zone over Syria, we're going to put in anti-aircraft stuff to prevent you doing that. And we're also going to... They've got. Don't forget, they had a very strong interest in defeating ISIS as well. Because, you know, the jihadis operate on the southern fringes of Russia,
yeah,
in Chechnya and so on.
So at least that's somewhere where the West and Russia are sort of unanimous. They want rid of ISIS.
Well, no, because what the rest of the Russian general staff believes and the Iranian general staff believes is ISIS, in fact, is a creation of Western... The Saudis, for example,
right,
who are our allies,
yeah,
are the major supporters of ISIS.
So if we go back to, as you predicted, World War III, which is going to happen next week, when Israel attacks Syria, we're in a very dangerous situation because Israel is an ally of the United States.
That's right.
Presumably they're up against Russians.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, in all seriousness, are we looking at World War III here?
Well, I think what's interesting about what happened last week with these bombings is that clearly what's happened was the Russians and the Syrians were told what was going to be bombed, and they got everybody out of the way.
Right.
There's no evidence of any casualties.
Okay.
Now, in other words, the Western politicians have locked themselves into a stupid thing where if they don't bomb, they look weak.
Right.
This is stupid. They should never have got themselves into that position, but they've got themselves into that
position. Okay.
So, in other words, a back channel was opened.
Right.
And what that really means is that they do not dare to carry out a proper assault on Syria.
Right.
Because the Russians are there. The Syrian army has been taking a beating. They've had 160,000 casualties. Do you think what the British army could take 160,000 casualties? But they've been fighting, and that's armies that have been fighting like that get better and better and better.
Mm. Yeah.
And can you imagine how would they invade Syria? They'd have to come in off ships, land on the coast, and go in that way. But there's no way they can do that.
No.
So in other words, the Syrians basically have won. But the West just wants to carry on, you know, basically sniping from the sidelines to prevent. You know, they don't want the situation stabilised.
Yeah.
They're trying to make as much trouble as possible for them.
Okay, well, let's listen to Theresa May justifying why these strikes happened on Syria.
With permission, Mr. Speaker, I would like to make a statement on the actions that we have taken together with our American and French allies to degrade the Syrian regime's chemical weapons capabilities and to deter their future use. On Saturday the 7th of April, up to 75 people, including young children, were killed in a horrific attack in Douma, with as many as 500 further casualties. All indications are that this was a chemical weapons attack. UK medical and scientific experts have analysed open source reports, images and video footage from the incident and concluded that the victims were exposed to a toxic chemical. This is corroborated by first-hand accounts from NGOs and aid workers. While the World Health Organization received reports that hundreds of patients arrived at Syrian health facilities on Saturday night with signs and symptoms consistent with exposure to toxic chemicals. And based on our assessment, we do not think that these reports could be falsified on this scale. Furthermore, Mr. Speaker, the Syrian regime has reportedly been attempting to conceal the evidence by searching evacuees from Douma to ensure samples are not being smuggled from this area. And a wider operation to conceal the facts of the attack is underway, supported by the Russians.
Absolutely.
Mr. Speaker, the images of this suffering are utterly haunting. Innocent families seeking shelter in underground bunkers, found dead with foam in their mouths, burns to their eyes, and their bodies surrounded by a chlorine-like odour. Children gasping for life as chemicals choked their lungs. The fact that such an atrocity can take place in our world today is a stain on our humanity. And we are clear about who is responsible. A significant body of information, including intelligence, indicates the Syrian regime is responsible for this latest attack. Open source accounts state that barrel bombs were used to deliver the chemicals. Barrel bombs are usually delivered by helicopters. Multiple open source reports and intelligence indicates that regime helicopters operated over Douma on the evening of the 7th of April, shortly before reports emerged in social media of a chemical attack. And the Syrian military officials coordinated what appears to be the use of chlorine weapons. Mr. Speaker, no other group could have carried out this attack. The opposition does not operate helicopters or use barrel bombs. Daesh does not even have a presence in Douma. And the reports of this attack are consistent with previous regime attacks.
So there you go. That's Theresa May's justification for the bombing. Obviously, you question the whole existence of the Douma.
I think that's a lot of that. So when she talks about NGOs and so on, she's talking about the White Helmets, who are basically their glove puppet club puppet organisation. And of course, she said Daesh isn't operating in Douma. Al-Qaeda is operating in Douma. Jaish al-Islam, who are the last holdouts in Douma, are Al-Qaeda. And of course, Al-Qaeda has been working very closely with Western intelligence services, the Saudis and us, the Turks, for years. Years and years, going back to the 1980s.
No, but she went to great lengths to sort of talk about these various other sources of you know, that had corroborated these attacks. You know, open source, she mentioned, and there must be a number of NGOs.
But this will all come out. I mean, the fact is, I mean, when she says and they've carried out previous attacks, if we go back to the previous attack in Ghouta, where there definitely was a chemical weapons attack in Ghouta in 2014,
yeah.
But all the evidence, Seymour Hersh's article, The Red Lines and the Rat Lines, you can look it up online in London Review of Books. He was the guy who exposed the My Lai massacre in 1972. He's a very, very senior US journalist. There's Tim Poston, I think, from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. There's a whole lot of... And what actually happened there was... And they showed that it couldn't possibly have been the regime for various reasons. The Massachusetts Institute of Technology showed, because the missiles couldn't have come from the direction that they say. People need to look into the detail here.
Right.
Now, what actually happened there is the Al-Nusra Front, again, another affiliate of Al-Qaeda. Do you think Al-Qaeda would gas civilians in order to try and win a war? I think they would, and they did. And the sarin they used had come from Libya, as far as we can tell. And Seymour Hersh has got excellent contacts inside the CIA, and that's one of the reasons why he was able to write the article. They wouldn't put it in the New York Review of Books, but it was in the London Review of Books. And what that means, in actual fact, is that NATO and Al-Qaeda together have used chemical weapons on civilians in order to try and make the Assad regime look bad. And everybody in Syria knows this, actually. The day after the so-called attack, there was a delegation of church people from Britain in Syria, and they went to talk to the Orthodox Patriarch in Damascus, and he said, well, we just don't accept that your narrative about this at all. We don't use chemical. I mean, don't forget, the OPCW agreed that the chemical weapons stockpiles of Syria were all handed over in the agreements that were made after the previous attack. Yeah, they gave them a clean bill of health. And of course, the original attack in 2014 not only was not carried out by Assad, it was carried out by Western intelligence services in order to try and make Assad look bad. And it's all very well saying, well, that's too conspiratorial. This is the Middle East. This is what happens. This is what's going on. It's not as straightforward as people think. And, it actually makes me quite angry. Because, in other words, there shouldn't be red lines about chemical weapons anyway. It's a load of rubbish. I mean, people being blown, have their heads blown off by a rocket-propelled grenade is just as evil as being killed by a chemical weapon. But the fact is that if you're going to have a red line of not using chemical weapons, then it turns out that NATO have actually used chemical weapons. When do we start shooting NATO generals? That's what I'd say.
Let's hear Jeremy.
I'm not kidding.
No, I think you make a fair point. But obviously, clearly, NATO generals are never going to be up against the firing squad, are they? Because
it depends where we go, doesn't it? Did you see General Shaw? He was in command of US British forces in Iraq. He was interviewed for Sky News. And he made the obvious point that virtually all the rebels in eastern Ghouta have been cleared out. There's only a tiny fraction of them left. There's absolutely no motive for the Syrians to use chemical weapons. It just doesn't make any sense for them to do it. And he made that point, and then the Sky News people just immediately cut him. Yeah? Shut him up immediately, making the obvious point. But of course, it's been twittered all over the place. And of course, the former head of the British armed forces in Iraq is absolutely right. There is no motive for use of chemical weapons. The suggestion that they would use chemical weapons in such circumstances is absurd. And of course, the previous attack, they'd got chemical weapons inspectors coming in, and on the very day the chemical weapons inspectors arrived, they supposedly use chemical weapons on their own people, except it wasn't them, it was the Al-Nusra Front working with MIT, the Turkish intelligence operation. Right. And of course, a lot of this detail, most people haven't got the time or the inclination to look into.
Well, indeed.
So when Theresa May says in her school-marmish voice that we have information that this and that and the other's true, then the more gullible people in Britain will believe it. But there's no reason to believe it.
Well, that's why we're here. But let's hear Jeremy Corbyn's response here. And just... I'm thinking about the context of Jeremy Corbyn's role. So he has to, you know, on the one hand, I'm sure you're a supporter, and Jeremy Corbyn fans will say he's a, you know, an honourable, incorruptible kind of guy. Mm. On the other hand, he's got to play politics and he's got to sort of present a robust front in
let's see what he has to say.
I just want to sort of set the context on you know, how he has to perform.
Mr. Speaker, this statement serves as a reminder that the Prime Minister is accountable to this Parliament, not to the whims of the US President. We clearly need a War Powers Act in this country to transform a now broken convention into a legal obligation. Her predecessor came to this House to seek authority for military action in Libya and in Syria in 2015, and the House had a vote over Iraq in 2003. There is no more serious issue than the life and death matters of military action. It is right that Parliament has the power to support or stop the government from taking planned military action. And Mr. Speaker, the BBC reports that the Prime Minister argued for the bombing to be brought forward to avoid parliamentary scrutiny. Will she today confirm or deny those reports? I believe that the action was legally questionable. And on Saturday, the United Nations Secretary General, Antonio Guterres, said as much, reiterating that all countries must act in line with the United Nations Charter, which states action must be in self-defence or be authorised by the United Nations Security Council. The Prime Minister has assured us that the Attorney General had given clear legal advice approving the action. I hope the Prime Minister will now publish this advice in full today. The summary note references the disputed humanitarian intervention doctrine, but even against this, the government fails its own tests. The overwhelming humanitarian catastrophe due to the civil war in Syria is absolutely indisputable. But the Foreign Secretary said yesterday these strikes would have no bearing on the civil war. And the Prime Minister has reiterated that today by saying this is not what these military strikes were about. And Mr. Speaker, does, for example, the humanitarian crisis in Yemen entitle other countries to arrogate to themselves the right to bomb Saudi airfields or their positions in Yemen, especially given their use of banned cluster bombs and white phosphorus? Mr. Speaker, three United Nations agencies said in January that Yemen was the worst humanitarian crisis in the world.
So, Corbyn there, pretty much on the attack and not very supportive of Theresa May's action. What about his sort of general... I mean, I know you're not a lawyer, but there is this general point that
there is no legal basis, frankly, for this. I mean, it's quite clear. You're not allowed to just say... don't forget that the only three countries that did this were Britain, US and France.
Yeah.
They cooked it up amongst themselves, said, oh, this is a terrible... you see, they've developed this doctrine that when terrible things are happening, then we can ignore the rules because it's just it's a very extreme circumstance. Mm. But as Jeremy Corbyn pointed out, the most extreme circumstance on the planet at the moment is Yemen, where people are... There's a blockade... which one they're not letting food in, so they're starving the population, and the Royal Navy are participating in this blockade. Now the Russians could say, right, well, okay, if you're going to take this line that you can, when you decide that somebody else has used chemical weapons. Incidentally, of course, if they were attacking chemical weapons facilities, there should have been, what would happen if the Russians dropped something on Porton Down? It'd be all over the place, wouldn't it? But in actual fact, these are empty buildings because the OPCW agreed that they'd given up all their chemical weapons. The Syrians gave them up.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So they haven't got any. That's their line. But of course the Russians could say, right, well, what's going on in Yemen? We're not very happy about that. British are involved, so we're going to nuke Porton Down.
Mm.
Because if you can do what you like, we can do what we like.
Yeah.
Yeah? There's no rules, and we're moving into a no rules situation.
Yeah.
And the Russians' policy has always been, we want to stick to the rules. But if there are no rules, I mean, one of the things they could have done, for example, is just put a missile onto the RAF base in Akrotiri.
Yeah.
Kill them all.
Yeah, yeah.
because that's, you know, the people in Britain who think that voting about having a war, why don't we have a war? Well, they need to realise that if you go to war, you may get hurt. It's not just the other people who are going to get bashed by you because you're the West and you can do what you want. Mm. The Russians are now in a position to really hurt them if they fight back. For example, the Mediterranean and the Gulf are in fact death traps. Yeah?
Yeah,
the Russians have got the military capacity now to sink all of NATO's ships. That's what Putin's big speech was about, the second part of his speech before he was elected.
Right.
So if we went to war, the first thing that would happen is that all NATO ships in the Mediterranean would be sunk quickly. And then, as World War III developed, they'd have to build new ships or whatever. But if the point is, we don't want to go to war, do we? It's silliness. But why go around provoking people if you don't want a war?
Mm.
And I think Corbyn was very right to concentrate on the legality there rather than argue the toss about whether it was a chemical weapons attack or not or whatever. And because that was a lot of bluster, frankly.
Mm.
I think it's going to come out that it wasn't.
Yeah. Let's talk about France's role in this, because France joined in this military action, and France are not renowned for being supporters of the USA, are they?
So
they must have a different agenda.
Macron is very much, you know, he used to work for Rothschilds, he's a banker, he's very much in the Tony Blair mould, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
And he probably saw it as a way of currying favour with, you know, powerful forces that were, you know, behind his election. But nobody else. They didn't ask anybody else to participate because they knew the answer was going to be no. And that's the point. I mean, Britain, France, and America decided on their own bat to go ahead with this. But there's no legal basis for that in international law. You can say, well, there is no international law.
Yeah.
Okay, maybe there's no international law. But when the Russians put their missile onto the Akrotiri base, that's within the rules as well. And of course, they could have argued in self-defence that's what they were doing. Yeah,
mm.
They would be in international law. They would be right because British tornadoes flew from that base, bombed their positions. They're entitled to fire back. They didn't because they're sensible, but they could, and they'd have been within their rights if they had.
It's 20 to 8. I reckon we've talked about Syria enough, but we'll stick with World War III because Trump is planning to talk to the North Koreans, and indeed, I believe some of their CIA director Mike Pompeo has already been to North Korea to meet.
It's rather surreal, isn't it? I mean, one would hope that there's something sensible will come out of this. It's hard to see because the American demand that they must give up their nuclear weapons, you can see from the North Korean point of view, why would we want to do that? You're coming to talk to us because we've got them, and if we gave them up, you would just spit in our faces. So there you go. But of course, they've got what they wanted, which is to talk directly to the Americans.
Right.
The South Koreans are now suggesting what we need is a peace treaty. Yeah, between the North and the South, which the Americans and the Chinese can then underpin.
But there is a de facto peace treaty. They're not at war. I mean, it might be a ceasefire.
But it's still very tense. You know, if you're thinking positively about this, the South Korean leadership are not very belligerent about this.
No.
You know, they're actually quite keen not to be belligerent. And I think that's helping quite a lot. Ultimately, what could come out of this is a kind of peaceful growing together of the two Koreas. And, of course, South Korea is actually quite an economically advanced country now. And they could easily, if they were allowed to, help the North Koreans to improve their living standards. Yeah?
Mm.
There's no reason why not.
No.
And the Chinese could also participate. And the North Korean regime could liberalise slowly. You can't expect them to change too much because it's too rigid. But they, you know, by getting involved in joint ventures and things of that sort, they could stabilise the situation. And that's, you know, that's a kind of glimmer of hope. But the sad what rather cynical person, I can't remember who it was writing on the internet the other day and saying, well, it's obvious that Trump is actually going to go to war with Iran because that's why he's being nice to North Korea.
Tell me more. Do you buy that?
Well, the Israelis want a war with Iran and Trump,
as well as Syria.
Well, no, but that's probably why he's being nice to the North Koreans, because you can't fight two people, you know. Mm. Yeah.
Well, the US probably could, couldn't it?
Well, they probably could, but they don't want to. Mm. The Israelis want a war with Iran. That's absolutely clear. They've been saying it for years. We want a war with Iran. We want a war with Iran. We want a war with Iran.
And what's their agenda?
They want to dominate the Middle East, basically.
Okay, so why pick on Iran in particular?
Because Iran is the main threat, as far as they're concerned, to their hegemony over the region.
Right. Not Saudi Arabia, not Egypt?
No,
not
Saudi Arabia is allied with Israel in their anti-Iranian hostility. Saudi Arabia and Israel and the West are the axis of evil, basically. Right. They are trying to... the Israelis and the Saudis are particularly bothersome, because the Saudis are, you know, led by this MBS, who's this 30-year-old crazy...
You know, prince or whatever.
Yeah,
king
crazy prince.
Yeah.
And the Israelis are, you know, certifiably mad in many respects in the kind of things they would want to do. And Trump, because of his own domestic political reasons, I mean, the whole recognition of Jerusalem, the fact that that's led to Hamas leading these kind of protests in Gaza, which have led to all the shootings. The whole situation is a powder keg.
Yeah, indeed. Let's go back to Trump. Trump's lawyer, Cohen, is under criminal investigation. What do we make of that? Is that significant, or is that
Honest with you, a lot of this stuff about how Trump was put in power by the Russian intelligence services is frankly codswallop. Just codswallop. And it's astonishing how many seemingly rational people can buy into this idea.
Yeah.
And as I said on Russia Today some months ago now, if the Russians are fixing Western elections to get the results they want, they're not making a very good job of it. Because Trump is now bombing Syria, threatening to, you know, he tweeted, you know, hey, Russians, my missiles are coming for you, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, that's really problematic when somebody like that just gets on their bloody phone in the middle of the night and decides they're going to bomb Syria before discussing it with anybody. And then, of course, they have to bomb Syria, otherwise he looks stupid.
Yeah.
And that's really... there's been a lot of face-saving going on here. Yeah?
Yeah.
Hopefully, touch wood, what's actually happened is the Russians and the Syrians... Basically, the Russians and the Syrians have taken... The Syrian army's taken 160,000 casualties. This airstrike's a joke. They didn't even kill anybody.
No.
So they're not intimidated by that.
No, but we go back to... Okay, so it's not the Russians who are fixing elections, but it is Cambridge Analytica and...
Oh, yeah, well, that is the real truth, is that the elections in the West are rigged, but they're not rigged by the Russians. They're rigged by the intelligence services working with the oligarchy. That's what goes on.
Yeah. Oh, where do we go next? Just one other point on Trump, actually. Comey. So former FBI director James Comey said that Donald Trump is morally unfit to be US president. Now, obviously, we all know that. But, I mean, do you think that's going to have any impact domestically for Trump?
No, well, Comey used to be a banker before he became head of the FBI. And he was actually responsible for money laundering for drug cartels.
Yeah.
And that made him a shoo-in to be FBI director. You know, I mean, Richard Dearlove, the former head of MI6, said about Jeremy Corbyn he couldn't possibly be prime minister because he'd never passed the vetting.
Yeah.
Now, you've got to realise how arrogant intelligence services have become. They really think that it's up to them to decide who's fit to be president or not.
Yeah.
I've got no time for Trump whatsoever. But the former head of the FBI, it's not in his job description to decide who's going to be elected as the president. And that's the problem here.
Yeah.
You're not supposed to be saying things like that. You're supposed to be a copper.
Well, we assume that there is some sort of security vetting of, politicians, don't we?
We do, but on the other hand, the point is what's happened is the arrogance of the intelligence services in the West is extraordinary now. They really feel that they ought to be, you know, have a veto on who can and can't be doing things. And we'll see this come to a head if Corbyn becomes Prime Minister, because I don't suppose that they're going to sit on their hands and just let him do what he wants.
No.
The steps will be taken. We can be sure of it.
Okay. By whom and what sort of steps?
Well, if you think back to Harold Wilson in the 1970s, he didn't take us into the Vietnam War, which put him on the black books of the Americans. And then if you've ever seen the Wilson plot, it's a BBC Two drama documentary about what happened at the time. MI5 decided that Wilson was a Russian agent.
Right.
And then they use the taxpayer resources with which they are gifted to undermine him and effectively drove him out of office. And, for example, one of the things they did was to have a huge security operation at Heathrow. Yeah?
Yeah.
With the army involved and all the rest of it. That hadn't been cleared by the Prime Minister. That was a message to the Prime Minister about what he had to do, which was step down.
Right.
That's what happened last time, and that was just Harold Wilson, who was pretty much of a cuddly toy compared to Corbyn.
Mm.
We can expect they are going to they're going to push back.
Yeah,
we do expect it.
Of course, assuming he wins, and
they're going to try hard to stop him winning.
Well, I think
that's the other thing that's going to happen.
The problem is
they're going to be doing their best to make sure he doesn't.
As I've argued before, Jeremy Corbyn himself will do quite a good job of making sure he doesn't win.
Well, we'll see.
I
think he's done a pretty good job actually over the last few weeks. Because if John McDonnell, for example, he was calling for Russia Today to be people not to go on it or for it to be banned. And John McDonnell, I've been to loads of meetings with John McDonnell about the Irish Republican struggle for years, blah 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 blah, and he wants to ban me from the airwaves. And now Corbyn just wouldn't go along with any of that. If McDonnell had been the leader, he would have been tempted. You know, I really think that if anybody else had been the leader of the Labour Party, they'd have been tempted to go along with Theresa May just for the sake of a quiet life.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
Corbyn has actually got principles and backbone.
Oh, undoubtedly.
And
undoubtedly.
He's prepared to be unpopular as long as he thinks he's right.
Mm.
And that's actually to his credit.
Yes, but it's not the way to win elections. That's
necessarily, but you don't want to win by just, you know, winning just for the sake of winning.
But there is a happy medium somewhere, isn't there?
Well, there is. Yeah. We will see. I think it's going to be very interesting to see how this plays out in the local elections in May. If all of this kind of Russia is trying to destroy us all and Corbyn's a Russian spy, blah, 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 we'll see how that plays out.
Yeah.
If the Labour Party do well, and they're expected to do well, and the opinion polls show that they are going to do well, it's going to be Theresa May who's going to be looking down the barrel of the gun, not Jeremy Corbyn.
Yeah. Okay, let's move on to France. We've mentioned Macron here. Mm. There's this suggestion that Macron is the heir to Blair, and that he is, you know, becoming much more right-wing than actually people thought.
Well, I mean,
he was
pretty right-wing from the get-go. Don't forget, he only got elected because Marine Le Pen was the other alternative.
Right.
And the left weren't going to vote for Marine Le Pen, so they were forced to vote for Macron to keep Marine Le Pen out.
Right.
But in actual fact, Macron has only got a very limited support. Yeah?
Yeah.
But in the system in France, you've got to vote for him if you don't want Marine Le Pen. And that's how he ended up winning.
Right.
But in actual fact, most of the people who voted for him don't like him. They voted for him because he's the least worst alternative.
Okay.
That weakens him.
Yeah, indeed. And he's also controversially proposing state control over the financing of mosques as a sort of fight against Islamic extremism.
Well, yeah, but I mean, that's the sort of Blairite position. You know, we know that most extremism pushed in Britain in mosques is funded by the Saudis. We know that because there was a government report about it, which they wouldn't release. The same will also be true.
How do you know about it then?
Well, because the Liberal Democrats called for it after we decided we were going to bomb ISIS in Syria, but they won't release it. In actual fact, all over the world, it's well known that Saudi money funds most extremist mosques.
Right.
And the obvious thing for us to do is break our alliance with Saudi Arabia, support revolutionaries in Saudi Arabia, and get rid of the regime there.
But we don't have to go that far, do we? I mean, surely there's a slightly more, how can I put it? Let's just suck up to the Saudis a little less. Let's just be
we can certainly do a little less sucking up.
Yeah.
But I think actually, because of everything that's happened, we're moving now towards a situation where Saudi Arabia is a fake state, really. It was created by the British in the 1920s to control the oil. And it's not got any real legitimacy. There's no elections. The oil industry in the East is mostly staffed by Shia, who hate the government. Saudi Arabia is a glass pillar which will shatter at some point. And, of course, the Israelis have also got to be made to behave themselves, a bit like Serbia. They've got to be told, you can't do this. We didn't let the Serbs do this, and we're not going to let you do it either. And that, of course, is where all of this is going. There's going to be we're all going to the OK Corral here.
Now, you probably know an awful lot about these guys, Bell Pottinger. According to an investigative report, PR firm, which is a British firm, I believe, Bell Pottinger, ran a secret campaign in Iraq funded by the US in order to achieve what?
What they were doing was creating fake Al-Qaeda videos.
Okay.
But they were paid for by the US taxpayer. So, in other words, when you go online, Rita Katz has got, who's an ex-Israeli intelligence officer who's based in the US, she's got a website called SITE, Searching Internet for Terrorist Entities. And surprisingly enough, ISIS seemed to put most of their videos up on her website first. And the fact of the matter is that many of the what people think of as ISIS videos are actually being created by Western PR companies and psychological warfare outfits, and we're actually living in a world where our own taxes are being used to create disinformation so that we will believe certain things and do certain things.
Yeah,
it shouldn't be happening, but it is.
Of course, but you don't suppose they were behind the Syria gas attack video, which may or may not have been
faked?
Well,
that was the White Helmets.
Right.
And we know that they are funded by basically US and British taxes, and they're embedded with Al-Qaeda. The only places the White Helmets work are with Al-Qaeda. And in fact, they've got similar, you know, some of the personnel are the same. And the whole thing of wearing white helmets is just a kind of shtick. Yeah, you don't need to wear a white helmet to go around rescuing people. And strangely enough, they also film themselves doing it all the time. There is actually a real civil defence in Syria, which is mostly based on the government side. And they have proper kit, and they go out and rescue people.
Yeah.
This lot is just, you know, when they ran into the video that Theresa May was referring to, just shows a load of people coughing in a hospital, and then people throwing water over them and spraying them with hoses, and that is not a serious. It's just not serious.
Well, no, it's not a serious attempt to deal with a chemical attack, is it?
No,
I suppose
it's not.
You know,
the straight faced way in which they go on about, well, we all know that they've carried out chemical weapons attacks.
Yeah.
Well, all we know is that chemical weapons have been used, but largely, as when we've actually looked into it, by the regime's opponents to make the regime look bad. The regime is winning the war because they've got the overwhelming support of the population, and they control all the urban areas virtually.
Yeah.
And you know, they should. Roland Dumas, who's the former French foreign minister, was interviewed on French TV about 4 years ago, 5 years ago now, and he said, "When I was in Britain before the Arab Spring, I was approached by British officials who said to me, 'We are going to run an armed uprising in Syria. Do you want to participate?'" Now, in other words, the Syrian war, which has killed 500,000 people and made millions homeless, was started by British intelligence to get rid of Assad. We are the guilty party. Yeah.
Mm.
And well, somebody ought to be sent to The Hague for that.
Yeah, that's going to be quite hard to prove, though, isn't it?
Yeah, but at the same time, I think people need... I'm not going to be browbeaten and bamboozled and emotionally blackmailed by people who are actually behind all of this.
Yeah.
We're going to be robust in calling it out.
Again, I think I'm going back to a point that I started the show with, really, or started this hour with, about just not knowing who to believe. And again,
well, that's right. That is a problem for ordinary people, isn't it?
Mm.
When everybody's out there trying to bend your ear, it's very difficult to make your mind up what the truth is.
Yeah.
Now, obviously, I spend a lot of my time trying to work it out. You know, because I'm not just for this show, but I'm fairly regular on Russia Today, as you know, and I have to know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I think it's not a bad rule of thumb to say that when we don't know what's happened, let's just say we don't know what's happened, rather than jumping to conclusions.
Yeah.
You should always, you know, suspend belief until you've actually got some evidence to go on.
Yeah.
And I think that's a good policy for ordinary folk who haven't got the time to look into it all. Just don't believe everything you hear.
We've got about 3 minutes left just to tackle the other really big story that's been around for a while, the Skripal poisoning.
Yeah.
And senior civil servants are still deeply sceptical, apparently, in the UK that the Russians were behind it. Again, taking this view that we really don't know, we don't know who to believe, what do you make of it and where
well,
can you
look for
evidence?
Well, I was on Russia Today this week talking about that on Wednesday. As a French anti-terrorist police officer called Paul Burrell, who's retired now, and he gave an interview about 2 years ago, and he said there is a massive operation to destabilise relations between Russia and the West, and the code name for this operation is Operation Beluga. and it's related to the Litvinenko. He was actually one of Berezovsky's security detail based in London.
Right.
And he said the Litvinenko murder, the Skripal. He didn't mention anything about Skripal because it hadn't happened then. But he said that there's an underlying desire by Western intelligence services to basically mess up relations between with Russia and the West, and that they're engaged in these kind of provocations to prevent a good relations.
Yeah. Even though we're still buying gas off them.
Well, exactly. This is what's so silly about all of this. We live in an interdependent world, but people are still playing 19th century realpolitik with 21st century weapons.
Yeah.
We ought to have grown out of this. We're a tiny speck in the middle of space. do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
but
absolutely.
But this kind of 19th century thinking, you know, the seeing people as opponents, enemies, you know, whatever, it's just idiotic think, really.
Yeah,
the future is mutual cooperation, if we've got one.
And you'd think, the other thing, of course, you'd think the Russians would be a bit more subtle about it if they
were. Well, as a Russian intelligence officer said, if we'd wanted him dead, he'd be dead.
Yeah.
And in actual fact, what's bizarre about this is nobody's died. They're all alive.
Yes, it's a failed operation, if it is an operation, indeed.
And of course, they also, Boris Johnson said, well, we know it was the Russians because Porton Down had told us, but we already knew Porton Down had tipped off Craig Murray that they hadn't said any such thing.
Oh, yeah. Right, okay, so Boris is...
Yeah, Boris was...
Allegedly tulling porky pies again.
Can you believe it?
I have to...
It's hard to believe that Boris could have been telling fibs, but there you go.
Sometimes I feel I've just got to give him the benefit of the doubt, but...
not today.
Not very often.
Now, I think both chemical weapons attacks, I think the wheels are coming off the wagon about both of those stories. And, you know, this is the modern era where people got the internet and investigative journalists can look into things. They could come out of this looking very, very bad indeed.
Yeah.
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 To deliberately create two incidents like that and then to be shown that both of them were wrong, then, you know, the government might start to be becoming quite wobbled.
Yeah. Martin, we'll have to leave it there. Thank you very much as ever. That's the end of the Politics Show for today. Tony Gosling will be back next week. I'm Steve Satan. Thanks for joining us. Hope you enjoyed it.
Is Bristol's BCFM on 93.2 online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.